you too, your listeners, have coped with change very well in the past, I'm sure. There's been situations they've had to deal with, things have come up, and they have been able to manage it in the best way possible. And so I think reminding yourself of when you've been able to do that, and what was it that got you there? How were you able to be resilient and bounce back? And then really think about, well, if I've done it before, I can do it again.
A message that you may hear a lot these days is that our world is more volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous than ever before. Change, of course, is a part of everyday life, individually, organizationally, as a community, and as a world. We're joined today by Susan Levin, an experienced global facilitator, coach, trainer, mediator, and organizational development practitioner, and we explore the concept of change and the relatively new field of change management. What happens to us internally in the face of a changing environment? How do we build our capacity to coexist with change? How does leaning into our strengths enable us to better handle change? And how can we collectively work together to ensure that change leads us to a brighter future?
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Woven Wings Live, where we bring you wisdom and tools for vibrant living. I am your host, Gabe Crane. I'm joined by my co-host, Rahul Deedwania. And today, we are joined by Susan Levin, who's an expert in change management and is an international consultant with USAID. And we are going to be exploring the topic of embracing change, finding center in a volatile world. And so, this is a vast topic, change and change management. Because Susan's with us today, and we'll introduce her more fully in a moment, we're going to have an opportunity to look at this, you know, really profound foundational idea in human experience from a range of different angles, and including some modern angles, and how we can manage change in a variety of circumstances, including our personal lives, to bring positive benefit to our lives, to make change more positive. And so before I bring in Susan, Rahul, I just want to say what's up. It's great to be back with you. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on our topic for today, embracing change.
Thank you, Gabe. Great to be here with you as always. And my immediate thought on this is, I think this idea about talking about change, right, can often feel a little bit trite. You know, it's like, hey, the only constant is change. And, you know, those kinds of statements always pop into my mind. And I'm eager actually to actually build a informed, intellectual framework around this. And I think I've often found myself thinking about this idea. You know, I think we're constantly bombarded with this message of like, the world is changing faster than it ever has. And you know, whether that's true or not, it's definitely something I feel or have been made to feel one way or another. So in that sense, I think I'm excited to understand it better and also to understand how to cope with it. You know, I think change is a constant, right? And that change is true on the macro level. It's true throughout life on the individual and personal level. And so eager to learn more and curious what this topic brings out for you, Gabe.
Well, I think it's in large part has to do with, you know, moving through that cliche that you described, right? Of like, oh, okay, this is a truism, change, right? To really consider that, you know, it's a truism and a cliche for a reason, which is that this is a very foundational, core experience for being human or being alive. And so having the opportunity here today to dive into a more rich and engaged, nuanced engagement with the topic, I think, you know, I think is going to be personally beneficial, and I hope it's helpful to our listeners at home too. And so on that note, I just want to take this moment to introduce our guest a little bit more fully. And our guest today is Susan Levin. She is a global facilitator, coach, trainer, mediator, and organizational development practitioner. She has more than 30 years of experience. As I noted earlier, she's done a lot of work with the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, in more than 40 countries. She has a big emphasis, which you're going to be asking her today about, on maximizing individual and organizational strengths in the face of change. And so looking at this strengths-based and appreciative approach to helping her clients to leverage into best practices and achieve a future vision. And so Susan's work has taken her all around the world, in Africa, in the Middle East, and we're very, very lucky to have her with us today. Susan, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, I'm so glad to be here with both of you. Thank you for that introduction. And I look forward to our conversation here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. It's awesome to have you. And I think maybe a place to start is where Rahul and I just were at, which is that sense, you know, change is this fundamental and also deeply philosophical concept. You know, Rahul mentioned some of those statements. You know, the only constant is change. You can never step in the same river twice. How do you understand and define change? And how do you relate it to this idea of change management?
That's so funny that you mentioned those cliched statements as I was thinking about those as well. There's the other one, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, which is part of considering when not to change. But I think, as you say, that change is reflected everywhere, all the time. And I think if we also look at it in nature, right, there's that things are always shifting, adapting, and there's decay, there's entropy, there's death, and then there's rebirth. And so, you know, this morphing from one cycle to another is just, it's just really natural. And perhaps if we accepted and thought about that more as that we're just part of the natural world, maybe we'd see change differently. Maybe it's a matter of reframing how we see it that could be helpful.
I like this idea of change being natural, you know, and it being something that we're just surrounded by. And that, to me, begs this question of even this word of management, right? Like, change management. It's like, how did this idea of managing, this natural process that we see all around us, that we experience personally, that we see, you know, within people, organizationally, yada, yada. How did this idea of management arise and how did this field develop?
That's a really great question. And there's also a definition of change management that I really like that Peter Senge, who is a professor at MIT, and he's the author of The Dance of Change and many other books. And he put it, he said, it's the capacity of a human community to shape its future. And I just really like that phrasing of a collective group of people deciding on where it wants to go. And when we talk about change management as an approach to dealing with transition or transformation, and we look at it as far as an organization goes, then we're talking about the goals and processes, the technologies, you know, different strategies to manage the shifts that are out there and all the competing priorities that different organizations have to grapple with. As you clearly said at the very beginning, the pace of change, right, is just so much faster than it used to be. I mean, I remember the days of before fax machines, so I'm really dating myself. And you had snail mail, and that was it. And I remember doing some international projects, and I'd wait for the mail to come to my home office and be able to then figure out what to do next. So this rapid speed is something that I think we're all just trying to figure out and grapple with. And if we look at change management as a field, it's really an emergent profession. And you know, people were not necessarily set out to invent it in and of itself. But because of all these changes and the demands on our thinking and how we do things in the workplace and such, it just became more and more of an interdisciplinary field, looking at a range of academic practice and very much based on experts in change management and their expertise and their practice. So it has definitely a social science foundation. And before the 1990s, psychologists, sociologists, they were really looking at the dynamics of change and how human beings were experiencing it. And so later on in the 90s, change management got on the radar and more into business vernacular. And so we were looking at, you know, results concerning change, wanting to move people through change. You may be familiar with John Kotter, who's written a lot about the 8 steps to managing change, and Spencer Johnson, who wrote a book called Who Moved My Cheese, about the need to recognize that change is happening and then adapting it with new action. And so in the 2000s, there was more rigor and structure brought in, more tested and proven tools and different positions out there, different jobs, different functions. So it became much more about making sure to integrate the people side of change. And I think that's where the field is really looking now, is looking at the humanization of the workplace. Because what's really important is we need to involve the people affected by the change in the strategies and in the tactics and make sure that they feel some buy-in and ownership. Otherwise, that change is not going to be sustainable. And what the research shows is most change efforts don't actually work. And it's for many reasons, and one of them being not including the people who are impacted by the change.
All that is really helpful to get an overview of this field and also your background, Susan, in this conversation. As we're talking, I find myself thinking about Buddhism. So I'm thinking about the Buddha and the doctrine of impermanence and that notion of change, and that we basically have to constantly deal with change. And what I find so interesting out of everything you've described is this rigorous, scientific, engaged manner in which this kind of interdisciplinary field has developed. And what's exciting about that to me is that it may have yielded more tangible and specific ways to deal with change than, you know, we've traditionally had in humanity. I think we look to systems, religions, traditions like Buddhism, right, that speak to that, point to that foundational truth, right? Or we see that in Greek philosophy as well. And yet here, I think we're looking at specific practices, tools, outcomes that we can use to meet that change and engage it differently. So my question is, you know, obviously our show is less geared towards professional applications, although we like to talk about that, and it's really more geared towards everyday life and people's personal lives. So I guess this is kind of a broad opening question, but how would you say that this field, as it's developed, has implications for people's individual everyday lives?
Well, one of the things that I think is so fascinating about looking at change is also looking at the way our brain operates. And there's been so much really fascinating work done in neuroscience and looking at the physiological ways that we react to change, because we are hardwired to resist it. We like to be in our comfort zones. We like what's familiar. And when you have change, of course, there's many new things that you are encountering and not necessarily expecting. And so what happens is we have an old part of our brain, which is called the amygdala, and that's our fight or flight center. And so that is our survival mechanism. That is the way that we are able to cope and deal with all kinds of what we might perceive initially as threats to our survival. And that amygdala was something that we had since we were cave people. So possibly 60 to 200 million years old. And so what I think that's so fascinating too about it, and if more people understood how we just react to change as an impulse right away, physiologically, if we meet people who are not of our tribe, so to speak, or people who are different than us, then our immediate reaction is to perceive that as a threat. And so the question really is then how do you move beyond that? Because it takes some seconds for the impulse to move from your amygdala, which is in the center of your brain, to the front part of your brain, your prefrontal cortex. And then you can make more rational, logical decisions. You can react to the change because you're giving yourself some time to do that. And that can really be helpful in terms of deciding what to do next. So this prefrontal cortex in the front of your brain doesn't fully develop in humans until we're in our, you know, mid to late 20s. And that's part of the reason why car rental companies don't rent to people under 25. And so maybe some of your listeners might have kids who are younger than 25, and maybe they do some goofy things, but it's really not their fault. It's their brain's fault. But you don't want to tell them because they'll have a reason, right? An excuse. So I think just linking the way that we tend to, as humans, we all, no matter what our ethnicity or background, this is our first reaction to change. And I think the real important and key piece is to recognize that, to understand it, and then be able to move past it to be more resilient, to be engaging, to stay curious about others and what's happening in the world. And I think that really connects to what you were saying, Gabe, about the Buddha teaching of impermanence, you know, that nothing lasts forever. And that, you know, we're interconnected in this world, not only from human to human, but human to living things, human to inanimate objects like rocks and the soil, mm-hmm. which is not inanimate, of course. Mm-hmm. So I think that more, you know, broad understanding can really help us all, I think, with reframing how we're dealing with change and how we can move forward.
And I'm curious to explore that threat response a little bit more. And, you know, we can go only as deep as it makes sense, but it's interesting, right? I think my immediate reaction to that would be like, oh, what was the like evolutionary benefit, so to speak, of having people be so like, you know, just responsive in that way, right? To like perceive all change as a threat. And, you know, there's the obvious place to go is like, hey, that a change in environment means there could actually be a physical threat, right? And that's what that response was. And I'm curious now, kind of in the more modern day, like, what does that threat response feel like in your view, Susan, like in terms of the emotional side, the physical response. You know, you talked a little bit about the mental or neurological response. I'm just curious if we could fill out that the image of what exactly is happening for us internally in response to change.
That's a wonderful question. And it makes me hearken back to the example of, you know, in as cave people, right? If the saber-toothed tiger was confronting you, your fight or flight response was either to get the heck out of there to survive, or to stay and fight, perhaps, or even freeze as a way to, you know, hope that that tiger will just kind of slink off. I think today, in certain places, obviously, there's still physical threats, but often there are emotional threats these days. So perhaps we're not included in a meeting, or we're criticized about something, some comment we've said, or we're on social media. And sometimes that can be very painful in terms of reading and seeing responses to our commentary. And so the triggering of the amygdala, it still happens. And actually, even if we're not physically harmed, the emotional sense and the what it can trigger in us, it can feel as if we are physically attacked, because the hormones get released. We've got the cortisol, which is the stress hormone. And so these things can still really happen and be very painful for us. And some of this, you know, these memories can be very deep-seated and long-lasting and bubble up at times we may even least expect.
So when it comes to this particular experience of emotional turmoil, what can we do? You know, I feel like, again, to kind of track back to these kind of traditional vantage points, I feel like the Buddha would be like, well, like, sit there and recognize what's going on and, you know, make a shift, stop acting that way. If I were to guess what he would say, you know, and it may take time. You may have to sit there and build your awareness. But what are, and I think that's probably a good foundation of advice for us as modern people, but what are, you know, in a more robust sense, ways that we can actively recognize when we're in a state of emotional upset, and then build resilience in order to be in a more positive, productive way with the change that's happening.
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, the first thing to note is how you feel physically in your body, because your emotions are going to be surfacing. And for some people, it's, you know, tight shoulders. Some people could get sweaty palms. Some people get it in their throat. Really important to notice that right away, that physiologically I'm feeling something, which means my amygdala, my emotions are being triggered. And so one of the first fundamental things that's so helpful to do is just take that deep breath. Because when we do that, we're calming ourselves, we're allowing the blood flow even to circulate more in our bodies. And it's also giving us some moments to just sit and be there and be in ourselves. And when you're feeling that attack, your emotions are triggered, or you're nervous about going into a certain situation, taking a really several deep breaths is just very, very helpful. Very helpful. And that builds the resilience. And I have a method that I call the PRC method, and it stands for pause, reflect, and choose. So in the moment, I want to pause before I react and be able to then take those deep breaths, because I don't have to respond immediately. And I don't necessarily have to be on autopilot, right? Responding in the way that I always do. I can choose I can choose to do things in a different way. And I want to reflect on why is this bothering me? That's the R part. I'm reflecting. What is going on here? And the more I can think about instances where I do get triggered, the more I can plan for it when I'm not in the moment. I have the ability to be able to then say, these are things that usually get me annoyed, push my hot buttons, get me nervous. Let me try to have a plan so I'm more ready for when I am actually encountering situations like that. So that's the choose piece. I can choose to do some things differently. And I think in the moment, especially when you're surprised by something, you've just got to take a moment to just step back, sit back wherever you are, stand back, and be able to give yourself some nanoseconds to really think about what's going on for you. And so when you are choosing to see it in a different way, it can be really helpful to try to be objective as much as you can. It's easier to say all these things than it is to do them, of course. But if you in that case can look at, okay, what is it that I think is important here? What is my point of view? How do I see the situation? And then let me get into the shoes of the other person. Let me see how they are perhaps seeing it. What's their perspective? And then what I want to do is I want to find the common ground between what I need and what the other person or persons, it could be people, it could be a group of people, are trying to get at. And let me find that nexus where there can be that common ground. And if I can do that and I get more practiced at it, I can get better and better. I can do it faster. I can cope better with my ego because I think the ego really stands in the way of that full connectedness that we can have with other people, with the change that's going on. And so it is definitely something that takes practice.
I'm reminded of that quote that I think is ascribed to Viktor Frankl, right? That idea of between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in that space is our power to choose, you know, choose our response and in a way find our freedom and our agency. And so if I'm tracking correctly, what I took from what you said is there's a situation. First step is to, you said, pause and to bring awareness to what's happening physically and to breathe, to sort of stop the automatic flow of our physical response, then to reflect and to choose. And in choosing, we're identifying what's important to me, what's the perspective of the other person, and really finding common ground. And over time, as we do this over and over, we will build an understanding of scenarios that elicit this response within ourselves and sort of track that pattern and build our capacity. And so that feels like a very complete picture. And my natural reaction to it is like, you know, and you started to allude to this, is like, hey, it sounds great, but why are we not able to do this, right? And ego, I know you mentioned, is one of those things that gets in the way, but what else? Like, what else gets in the way of any part of that puzzle? You know, the awareness, the pausing, the reflection, the choice. Just curious what you've seen in your experience around all this.
Well, I also really love that Frankl quote. I'm glad you brought that up. That's really so powerful. And, you know, I think the other thing that could help with this is, you know, you two, your listeners, have coped with change very well in the past, I'm sure. There's been situations they've had to deal with, things have come up, and they have been able to manage it in the best way possible. And so I think reminding yourself of when you've been able to do that, and what was it that got you there? How were you able to be resilient and bounce back? and then really think about, well, if I've done it before, I can do it again. And I think that builds the confidence to be able to prepare, be more ready, and slow down. You know, there's a great quote that goes, I go slow to go faster. And I think if we can remember to put that pause on how fast we react, or, you know, how quickly it affects us, and how, you know, the pain that can arise sometimes from that change. I think that can really be helpful. And there's an acronym I like to use that has been useful for some people, which is QTIP. So QTIP, which means quit taking it personally. And so sometimes just to remember that it isn't so much about you, you're just there in the situation. And if you can remember that it isn't directed personally, it can often be really, really useful, really helpful.
I like, Susan, the allusion you made to past successes of times when we've faced change, because to live in this world is to have dealt with change, and to still be here and listening to this show, or us making the show, going about our business, our day-to-day life, indicates that we've somehow survived to this point, which is no promise about the future, but it does give some positive energy to the situation. And I think that dovetails a lot with the approach that I've seen in your work, you know, visiting your website, knowing that you have a very strengths-oriented way of going about the work that you do. And it strikes me, I don't think I've got this quote exactly right, but when I went to your website, you know, kind of the first message that I felt I got was, let's talk about what's working, you know, versus what's not, which is commonly what we tend to do, is we look for the problems and we look for the way to fix them, to address them. And so I guess I'm curious if you can expand on this a little bit more for us. What is the benefit of leaning into strengths and things that are working when we're dealing with the turmoil that comes about from change?
Absolutely. And the other thing to note, of course, is there's so many times when change is positive, right? It's something that, you know, in our lives, we have our children, we perhaps find a really beautiful relationship. You know, for those people, maybe it's about making more money. I don't mind making more money. that's a good thing. So needless to say, I just wanted to make sure that we are also talking about the positive side of change, because it's a both and. And I do think it's the same with strengths and an appreciative approach. There are always things that are working in any system. Things are moving forward and interacting and working together. And so I find that in my work, when I start with that and I ask people, okay, what's working in the organization? What successes have you had? And this works on an individual basis as well. What are your key strengths? What do you do well? What are you good at? What are your competencies? What are you confident about? And I think it can really be so valuable for people to remember that. And it's not like we have to research it or look it up. It's just there. And I think that really speaks to the power of the question, right? If I'm asking the question, well, what is going well here? What strengths are you bringing to make that happen? I'm going to get a whole different set of answers than if I ask the what's not working, as you said, Gabe. And so you're right, people aren't usually asked about that. And I find that it can be so energizing and motivating to identify that, especially collectively. If a group of people can say and remember what they did well as a team, as a group, and when I'm doing my organizational change, I'm getting people to write this down. There's always power in writing something down. It makes it even more concrete. And we collect those and we look at it globally and comprehensively. And I've even had some clients who I coach, and they've taken those statements of what they've done well and what's working and what those achievements are and posted it in their office so they can continue to add to it as the group continues to make some really good progress. So interestingly, research says that when people get to play to their strengths at work, they're at least six times more engaged in their work. And that comes from a book called Strengths Finder by Tom Rath, which is published by the Gallup organization. And so there's, I think they've looked at, interviewed, you know, maybe almost a million people on this research. So it is really well founded to see that, because it also takes less work to be able to use what you're really good at and what you're best at, because it's already there. It's a lot harder to try to improve on an area that you need a lot of work to do. And some experts in this appreciative approach, appreciative inquiry, would even say, don't even bother with the areas of improvement. Just really focus on enlarging the number, the strengths that you do, increasing the number of times you get to do it. And from there will come that positive change.
I'm curious to understand that piece. You know, I think I've seen it definitely on an individual level, kind of more in an interpersonal dynamic where, hey, if people are aware of their strengths, they're playing to their strengths, they tend to just be more positive. And then that has sort of a, you know, ripple effect in just the way that they show up to any situation or any changing dynamic or, you know, any problem that they might face. But sometimes, you know, what's in front of you might not actually play to those strengths, right? And I think where my mind goes is like they're, you know, whatever change is being managed or whatever process is being faced can sometimes be playing more to your weaknesses, right? And I think when that happens, how do you channel, you know, what you just built in terms of what you described around focusing on strengths into that other arena, you know, of actually dealing with the thing that may not naturally cater to your strengths? Or is that actually just a misframing of how I'd even be looking at it? Just, yeah, curious what you think there.
That's a great question. I think if you're looking at a group of people, then what you have there ideally is you've got complementary strengths, because not, of course, no one is good at everything. And if you can be intentional about that, then you can bring on people that are going to have strengths in areas, in one area that maybe others are not as strong in. So you individually, clearly you do best, you know, with your own best thinking, your own best motivations, your own best actions. And sometimes, though, you will have to push yourself, right? Push those edges that you maybe didn't even realize you had to move forward, to be able to contribute in the best way possible in a particular situation. So I think the issue of looking at strengths both individually and collectively is not to say that everything is just hunky-dory, right? Looking at it through rose-colored glasses. But what it is then you come from that solid foundation to tackle the areas that are not so strong, or you have more bandwidth and brainwidth to do the hard work of tackling the problems, because you also have the energy of dealing with it. And collectively, people who do look at those strengths together, look at what we do well, look at how we are enhancing each other, it can be a very bonding experience that then collectively strengthens the whole group.
That's really interesting to hear, you know, the consideration of the individual level and then this key part of human life, which is our social dynamics and interaction and how we can source strength from, you know, the different traits that each of us bring to the table. We kind of find the right combinations and tapestry that kind of then uplifts the group as a whole. That's kind of what I'm hearing from you. And, you know, at this juncture, actually, I kind of feel called to just like relay as we're speaking, I'm noticing for myself just a kind of sense of upliftment and shift in the way that I'm feeling about my present circumstance. And it's interesting we're having this conversation today because as I was sharing with both of you before we started recording, my family all got COVID the last couple of weeks and we've been in this, you know, quarantining in our bubble. And then actually just today was first day that I ventured out and went to the grocery store and did some laundry. And I found myself experiencing, I didn't really have the word for it, but it felt vulnerable. I felt kind of fragile stepping out. And then we moved to Maui where we live about 2.5 years ago. And I still feel at different moments these, you know, pangs of uncertainty in the move and the difficulties in adapting to a new place and adjusting into all that. And I found all of that narrative up in my mind when I was out running my errands this morning of, oh my gosh, where am I? You know, am I in the right place? Kind of all these existential thoughts. And the conversation is just really helping me to understand, you know, what I'm experiencing there, you know, that I'm having on some level an emotional response, right, to a shift. And then that's getting linked to different thoughts and ideas. And then it can kind of quickly run away with itself if you don't have that pause, as you've been counseling us, that awareness to say, okay, here's where I'm at. And then as we're speaking, the image that's coming to me, we live on Haleakala on Maui, on the slopes of this big giant volcano. And, you know, we live in a country road. And I'm getting this image as we're speaking of kind of the wind or the natural elements kind of blowing through me up the road and being kind of carried along in that and finding some sort of solace or some sort of connection in that feels a lot better than the fear and the fragility and like the kind of freaking out, low level freaking out that was happening for me this morning. And it just, you know, the last image I'll share there is just that we were talking about ego and that image of the natural elements blowing through me feels like this. The problem that doesn't allow me to feel that is the ego, you know, is this like solid object, like the bowling ball of my own head that, you know, when that sort of subtle influence or that support starts to come through, you know, it kind of hits this wall and it doesn't go through. So it's like figuring out ways to kind of soften that through the breath to let this change happen and let life unfold and feel a more trusting relationship with what's taking place so that, you know, I can adapt and feel a sense of peace, a sense of calm, also a sense of direction and that a sense of security also in that, amidst change that like, there's a way that I can make sense of this. There's something I can do. And I don't know. I have a further question actually that I'd like to ask about, you know, this world that we live in, which can be a very scary place. But before I do, actually, I guess I'm just curious, Susan or Rahul too, as I describe that, like what does it evoke for you? And can you relate in any sort of way? Because I just feel like that is it's my experience from today, but I feel like that's an experience that we are all facing, you know, on these micro levels and sometimes much bigger in our day-to-day life. And it makes all the difference in the world to be able to have this shift that we're talking about, because it changes the very experience of what it means for me to be alive today.
Well, as you were saying that, Gabe, I was just smiling about the image of you being on this beautiful slope of the volcano with the wind coming at you and the trees swaying back and forth. And one of the things that I think can be really helpful for us is to remember that connection we have to the incredible Mother Nature that exists all around us. I mean, even if we live in an urban environment, there's a bush, there's a tree. And perhaps it can give us some solace to remember that interconnectedness that we have with all things, and that it's going to be okay. I'm just remembering this book I'm reading called Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Kimmerer. She's a professor and a member of the Potawatomi tribe. And she looks at the connection between living things and human efforts. How do we get a more sustainable world? And looking at through it the lens of indigenous traditions. And in that book, she talks about asking permission of the plants before you pick them and before you take them. And I think in our, you know, our world, it really is a both and, right? That we're probably not able, I don't know if it's even possible to stay in that beautiful image that you were describing about being in the wind and being in a beautiful hillside and such, that it's there, it exists, and we have all those challenges and threats and difficulty in the world and just really, you know, some really horrible things that people have to deal with. And perhaps there's a way to just be able to take all of that in and somehow be able to balance that, that it won't stay. It's part of the impermanence. Nothing stays in any status quo, you know, or any stasis for very long until something comes and rearranges it all before it gets balanced again. So I'm wondering what, you know, both of you think about, you know, that connection where we see now that there's been research on how trees communicate under the earth to each other in a very intricate web, and how what might be useful for us as humans to really look at change and manage it, accept it, be with it because of that interconnectedness with the universe.
Susan, what you just ran through and Gabe, what you were sharing, we're echoing so many themes, Gabe, I feel like we've explored in some recent episodes. You know, I think I was hearing Susan in that image you said about asking the plants permission or having that moment of intentionality. You know, we had this conversation around the art of taking, you know, and it was really oriented around that, right? I think around this moment of gratitude and intentionality and you know, deliberateness and just not kind of going into autopilot, right? And really thinking about what we're doing. And the other thing that was coming up for me, especially Gabe, as you were describing all of this, was this idea of paradox, you know, this idea that, hey, we do have all of these issues, we have this changing world, we have complexity, volatility, all of that is there. And we can't, you know, just turn a blind eye to it. We see it, we experience it, we live it every day. But there is a way to coexist with it, right? Where we see it, but where our natural response might be to go into, you know, perceiving it all as a threat and wanting to act on it in a certain way, that response actually paradoxically is the one that's going to make us less able to deal with it, right? And and this idea of slowing down, of pausing, of taking it in, but also not internalizing it so deeply that we're paralyzed by it, right? And rather finding our own choice, finding our own agency, our reflection, you know, all of that, and then being able to choose the response that we want to bring from a place of peace, you know, feels like where the empowerment lies. And that's just sort of what's coming over to me, is just revisiting these ideas and sort of seeing it all come together and swim together in this, in these images, you know, these images that have been brought out here. And yeah, I'll just pause there for a second and see if that sparks any reactions.
Well, I love what you're saying, Raul, about the choice. And I had a recent experience where I was coaching somebody, and she's from Kenya. And I was going through a turmoil in my life, my personal life, tumultuous. I was just had lots of things going on. I was just really feeling in a dark place. And she was talking to me about, she has decided she chooses to be content. And she is very, as you say, the intentionality, the agency to be able to do that. And it's not like it happens easily or happens all the time. But she, in other words, if she's going through a difficult situation and there's some change, what she normally would do is avoid it. Or, and then she'd get mad and she'd have all those emotions that can swell up so easily. And now she is pausing and she is determining that she's going to stick with the conversation and she's going to stay involved. And she is just choosing to be content. And I now have that on my computer, that saying, to choose to be content. And it's really helped me. I had a real physical shift in my body and in my whole outlook after that really profound conversation. And I think beyond content, there are moments of elation. There's moments of just pure, utter joy. And those, of course, those are fleeting, and those are not perhaps the majority of the time. But I think that we do have the wherewithal to really, in fact, what neuroscience will say is you can rewire your brain. You can change the way the neurotransmittance is happening in your brain by changing your habits, changing your outlook. And then what happens is it then becomes fixed in the brain. So it's so encouraging to know through neuroscience that we are not doomed and we don't lose the brain cells that fall out of our ears, you know, over time and aging, that actually it's a muscle that we can exercise. And so I find that really encouraging. And I also think we don't have to be stuck in those emotions. We need to acknowledge them. We don't want to ignore them, because they're giving us information, very valuable information. It's just that we want to move beyond, we want to bounce back from a challenging kind of condition. And we can. And the quicker you do that through what we've been talking about here, whether it's deep breathing, meditation, the great Frankl quote about, you know, taking that pause, the more we do that, the more we rewire our brain, the more it becomes more habitual, and we don't even have to think about it that much because it becomes part of how we move about in the world.
You know, just noticing how I'm feeling again as we're having this conversation and hearing both of your responses and kind of the vitality and richness, dynamic, the dynamism in the conversation, it it's just felt very cathartic for whatever reason to share with both of you my experience from this morning. And that is standing out to me as a possible tool as well. You know, it's the finding the way to work through the feelings, to share about it, to talk about it. And then through that, it is a choice, a choosing of something that's not that fear. And I really, you know, I wish that I could always articulate in one sentence or in English the different layers of the things that I feel sometimes when we're doing this show. But, you know, Rahul, it really brings me back to our intentions for doing this show, and that we have overcome our own fears and processes to be able to make this show happen and sustain it. And through that, have these rich conversations. And through that, kind of new realities end up getting cemented into place, Susan, as you just shared. And so that leads me to actually a question that's a reframe from what I originally thought. You know, originally thought I wanted to ask you about volatility and uncertainty and the terror that's in the world today, and the uncertainty we face with climate change and all that, you know, and everything. You know, it's just, it can sometimes feel like we're on the verge of a societal collapse, and, you know, and that fear just grows and grows and grows. But then paradoxically, here we are on the other side, feeling that contentment and that those moments of elation that you're describing, Susan. And that makes me want to ask you, rather, where do you feel change is leading us or can lead us when we take this approach? You know, is there an evolutionary direction to change that we can orient it towards, or an inspirational vision for a brighter future? Because I feel that sometimes in those moments when I have a moment of breaking through those emotions or conquering the fear, I feel like, wow, unbelievable. This is so exciting. There's something happening in the world, or that we're all in the long gradual process of working towards. So I'm curious, I think in light of our strengths and appreciative orientation that you've been sharing with us today, I'm curious about that. Do you see a brighter future for us through the process of managing change in this way?
Well, I have to say I am an optimist. So by nature, I see that positive. And as you were speaking, Gabe, I was thinking of a spiral image came to my mind. You know, when a leaf falls to the ground, it doesn't go straight down. As we know, it spirals about. And I think that's part of what's happening in our evolution as humanity. Is we maybe cycle forward and we make some progress, and then it comes back around to perhaps the fear or the threat or the reaction. And then we are able to move forward, and then it kind of cycles back. I do think, though, that evolutionarily with change, I do feel like humanity is moving forward, despite all the obstacles, despite what we see in the world. And I think if we think about it on an individual or personal level, what I think can be useful is to really look at what you can control and what you can't, because these issues are so overwhelming going on all around us in the world. They're scary. And I think, though, that if you really look at what you can control in your own world, and you can take action, you can make your contribution, you know, let's say to combating the climate crisis that's going on, right? You can do whatever small bit you can. And as Mother Teresa said, what we can do is we can all put our drops in the bucket, and the bucket will fill up eventually. So it can feel in that spiraling back and forth that we take some steps back and then we propel ourselves forward. And perhaps given how natural that is, maybe that's the course of where things continue to go. But I do feel like the whole spiral is moving in a forward direction. And that sometimes in a way, what it's coming back onto is like our basic elemental meaning of who we are to be human. That at a very basic level, it is about that interconnectedness. And it's not the separation that comes from the ego and the fact that I'm different than somebody else. So I want to say that I'm hopeful. And that, you know, what you two are doing, what all the contributions that everybody in the world are making to move us forward in this spiraling continual direction back onto ourselves, I'm hopeful that it will be there and we'll continue.
This notion, Susan, of contributing, you know, our drop, right? Like all of us collectively will be putting a drop in to fill up is such a beautiful image. And what was coming to me as you were sharing all of that was just that the serenity prayer, right? The idea of having the serenity to accept the things that we can't change and not allowing those things to get under our skin, to make us fearful, to make us negative and defeated, to actually have the courage to change the things that we can, like you were just saying. And then of course, you know, developing the discernment, right? The wisdom to actually distinguish between those two things. And I'm curious how you maintain this outlook that you just mentioned and the optimism that you just mentioned and this notion of, hey, we're all in it together, you know, that you've been embodying this whole time, right? And I guess all of that is a way of saying, like, what is your own practice, you know, whether it's spiritual or otherwise, to keep you grounded in this mentality and this approach and this way of looking at things?
And I do want to say, of course, that that is not always where I am, that I have my moments, I have my tough times. It's certainly not always the way it is. So it takes very much of an intentionality to choose to be content. Though I must say, I think and I hope what I'm doing is through practice, through meditation. I'm also very much, I practice a mindfulness meditation. I greatly admire the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh, who was a Vietnamese Buddhist monk. You may be familiar with him. And I just, it's like persistence, right? If you keep at it and you keep putting it out there and you keep putting things into the universe, I do believe that the universe does take care of us. And I want to come back to that so that if I'm quicker to bounce back or I'm quicker to be resilient, I think that is just so helpful. And when I remember the interconnectedness of all things and I remember to be mindful, to slow down and to breathe, it just helps me a lot. And I was very inspired by my background in Judaism when I was much younger. And one of the principles of Judaism that I really, really like is this practice of tikkun olam, which is this concept of doing action, taking action so that you can repair and improve the world. And I think that gives me the incentive to keep at it. Just the small things that I can do in whatever way, because cumulatively, I do think that we are all making that difference in the world. And it's just, you know, when you get knocked down, you got to get back up and keep at it, I think.
Well, amen to that. I want to just give thanks, Susan, for you being on here today with us. I really benefited personally from this conversation. It's just in the course of this hour, I'm feeling, well, I guess I could say I'm feeling great, but really more than that, I'm feeling deeply connected to a sense of meaningfulness and deeper clarity about my own personal situation. And so I just really want to thank you for that. And I feel that there are such rich, it's like we talked about at the outset, it's such an innocuous conversation that you know, you're like, where is that going to go? And it's just so many rich points that I think are just so helpful for everybody that have kind of come up over the course of this conversation. So I just want to say thank you so much for joining us. Really your depth, your professional expertise, and the balance of that with your own spiritual practice and perspective, your openness to consider all sorts of different perspectives, I think really comes across in everything that you share. And so, so thank you. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you so much for having me. And I really appreciate your very mindful and thoughtful questions. Both of you just helped me really go deeper. And I appreciate that so much. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Well, I think that is where we'll probably wrap up for today. Rahul, I'm curious if you have any last thoughts that you'd like to share with us or with our listeners before we close.
Yeah, just echo everything that you said, Gabe, and invite our listeners, you know, to think about where they've been successful in dealing with change. I think that was a takeaway that really stood out to me, you know, this notion of looking back and celebrating our successes and using that also to shine some light on our strengths and deriving a sense of agency and you know, positive pride and belief in ourselves, right? That we can coexist and manage and be with and channel change in a way that's constructive, both for ourselves and even more so for the collective. I think really just thinking about those moments where we've been the best version of ourselves and really appreciating that about ourselves is something I'd love for our listeners to really think about.
Amen. Well, thank you for that. I think that's, I wholeheartedly agree. And so on that note, we're wishing you out there strength and perseverance. Susan, you mentioned that. We will keep persevering and bringing you content like this. I think we all personally benefit from it, and hopefully it brings some benefit to you as well. So on that note, thank you for joining us again for another episode of Woven Wings Live, and we will see you next time. Take care and have fun out there.